This is KUOW Seattle. I'm Bill Radke. Thank you for joining us. Yesterday on this show, we aired a four-minute conversation with the man who took a bus to downtown Seattle wearing a swastika armband and got punched, knocked out on the sidewalk. Well, the overwhelming majority of you who we heard from agreed with this caller.
Hi, my name is Melissa from Seattle. I just wanted to comment on the fact that you gave a Nazi a platform, a very large one at that, to express their vile hatred, and that should be shameful. What sort of idiot says, yes, let the Nazi speak? And what sort of universe do you live in where listening to a Nazi sounds like a good idea? Nazis are the bad guys, everyone. Why have we forgotten this?
Thank you, Melissa. A lot of you asked that question. Why? Why would you put a neo-Nazi on the air? To answer that, I will start by quoting a listener named Kathy, who writes, "You need to be informed about all aspects of the society, including people you don't agree with. I am curious and need to know how a Nazi thinks. Thanks," says Kathy. But Harvey writes, "If your story is just to inform the public of our growing neo-Nazi groups in the Pacific Northwest, his actual voice is not needed. Call in a scholar. Call in a counselor who works with reformed hate groups. Call in a lawyer. Call in literally anyone else. Voices have power. Y'all gave power to a Nazi." Both Kathy and Harvey have legitimate points. A lot of people have been speculating about this man. Why did he wear a swastika? What did he want? We decided to let you hear from him directly. Now, you may think I let him get away with lies or dodges, and maybe I did. The unedited version was much longer than the one you heard, and I can tell you when I challenged this man's viewpoints, he responded with more of his viewpoints, and we only left in what was most relevant to our questions. Why did you do it? What did you expect? Now, let's get to an objection a lot of you had. As Mitch emailed us, you gave him a platform for his hateful rhetoric, his perceived victimization, and ultimately his agenda of white supremacists. You made a lot of neo-Nazis and white supremacists very happy because this man, although a victim of a crime, is getting people to sympathize with him and join his cause and ultimately spread his message of hate. So, a question for KUOW is, should we keep certain messages off the air? I'm reluctant to do that, but maybe there should be exceptions. One reason we might suppress someone's message in his own words is that it could pose a threat to safety. And what constitutes a threat to safety? On Monday, I interviewed an anti-fascist who explained why the swastika is a kind of assault.
What that symbol means is lampshades made of human skin. It's jewelry made of human teeth. It's the industrial extermination of an entire group of people, of my family, of my friends, of people like me. That symbol, those words, that ideology is violence.
The man who wore the swastika disagreed with that. He said imagery is not violence, and that's a debate a lot of people are having right now. Let's put this to somebody who studies Nazi history, University of Washington history professor Lori Manhofer. Welcome back to KUOW.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Would you call wearing the swastika an act of violence? How do you think about that question?
Well, so in Germany today, that it's a crime to wear the swastika, and that person would have been liable to arrest because symbols that incite violence are illegal under German law, and hate group symbols are as well, and the swastika is recognized as one of those. In this country, it's not illegal to wear a swastika.
Yeah, it's not illegal, and then the question is, should we air somebody who he put on that swastika, and as you've heard the interview, right?
Yeah.
So we argued about whether or not, and I was, as I was saying to him, to anybody I know, you will be seen as, legitimately seen as espousing the mass murder that you heard described. This man told me, I'm not a Nazi, this is an old symbol, and I should be able to wear whatever I want. You heard the interview. What did you think of that claim that in Germany, maybe it's seen as an incitement of violence? And he said he wasn't inciting violence.
Yeah, I think that guy did exactly what Nazis historically have done, which is to incite anti-fascists to violence. And you know what? I understand that people want to, I absolutely also feel I mean, it's outrageous that somebody was walking around wearing a swastika. I understand why somebody wanted to punch that guy, but that's what they do. They provoke violence, and then they get a media platform. And then once they're put on the air, they don't sound, they're very good at building bridges to moderate conservatives. They don't sound like wackadoodle neo-Nazis. So when you had that guy on, he talked a lot about free speech, and he made some arguments that probably appealed pretty broadly to people who don't agree with Nazism, but who do agree that free speech is an important value. And that's exactly what they try to do. And then the upshot is that the person who punched them and the people who support that person look violent, and they look like extremists, and the left looks violent and crazy. And that's exactly what happened. So, yeah, it's hard to watch it go down. And I think you guys are in a really hard position.
Yeah. Well, I want to talk more about that. It sounds like you're echoing what a listener said, who said that putting this swastika wearing man on the air, even for 4 minutes, the listener called it shameful collaborationism. I want to get at this, because first you said that in Germany, the swastika is seen as an incitement to violence. But
it's
you're
equally,
talking about then you started talking about inciting anti-fascists to violence, and the idea being that the government doesn't want that incitement and that violence on the street. That's different from seeing the swastika as an assault on groups who could be murdered under that ideology. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah, I think so. A lot of people, I think that there is a lot of weight to that argument that the swastika itself is an act of violence and that wearing it is an act of violence. But under American law as it currently stands, and I think this would be a really bad time to try to revise American law on this point, under our legal system, it is not recognized as an act of violence. You absolutely, unfortunately, in my view, you have an absolute constitutional right to walk around downtown Seattle wearing a swastika. So what happens is essentially vigilantism. People feel like they have to take the law into their own hands and they have to punch the person wearing the swastika. And I think that German law, it for all of its problems, I think that it's overall a more helpful situation to let the police step in and say, well, you can't wear a swastika. But that is not that is not the jurisprudence we have in this country. It never has been. It would never fly in the United States if Seattle tried to pass an ordinance. And I think that the anti-fascists should be mindful of that. I think that they should look at the bigger picture, because whoever punched that guy, you know, that is why the guy got on the radio. Journalists are in a bad position. You have to tell both sides of the story. You have to follow your code of ethics.
Okay, well, we'll talk about that in a moment. Do we have to tell both sides of the story? What does both sides mean? But you were talking just now about provoking anti-fascists to violence. I want to know, as a historian, what role have media played in contributing to innocent people being hurt and killed?
Well,
that's one of the concerns we have to decide as a radio station. Should we broadcast something that could harm, that could threaten? So what's the media's... What do you know about the media's role?
Well, the major contribution that media made historically that is relevant here is that they gave the fascists a platform. And when the fascists had a broad platform, when they were speaking to a broad audience, they were very good at presenting themselves as respectable, as far more moderate than they really were. And the guy you had yesterday said he was a
libertarian.
Came across as a libertarian,
yeah.
Right? And building bridges to moderate conservatives. And then the way that they come to power historically is they get moderate conservatives on board.
Yeah.
It's not the case that in Germany, if in 1932 everyone who was against fascism had gone out and punched a Nazi in the face, the Nazis would not have taken power. They still would have taken power, because they took power because moderate people on the right got behind them. And that's what they do when they get a platform. They appeal to those people. So that's where the media contributes. And again, I think you guys are in a hard situation, because you're also liable to the claim that you're not telling both sides of the story and that you're not being fair. And that's dangerous too.
Yeah. Well, how about that? Multiple dangers. As you said, KOW, basically you said, gave... he doesn't call himself a neo-Nazi. Now we're back into but he gave this swastika wearing man a platform, a moderate sounding platform. Do you think KOW should have put him on the air?
Oh my
god. You be the editor.
That's hard.
You be the editor. You be the host. Do you put him on the air? Because we aired that interview on tape and edited it way down.
Yeah.
Do you put that on the air?
It's a hard call. So I think about some of my students who are on the right. And I think that the fact that you put him on the air would gain KUOW some credibility with them, because they would say, look, they are letting this person tell their side of the story. And at the end of the day, that's a good thing, because when my conservative students turn to news outlets that are absolutely based in conspiracy theories and fantasy like Breitbart, I think that that's more dangerous. At the same time, I think as editors and as journalists, there are ways to cover stories. You know, if you think about like the journalistic code of how you cover, if you're going to cover suicide and how you cover suicide, and whether it's news and then how you're going to do the story.
That's a good example.
One of the comments that you read about isolating the issues rather than letting the person have a platform. At the same time, I think then people on the right are going to turn around and say, well, no, everyone should be able to tell their story. The fact that this is news, I think, is really interesting. So it was a viral video, right? I
mean, yes. The video of this man getting laid out, knocked out.
KUOW doesn't cover every fist fight that happens in Seattle.
Right.
So why?
This fist fight seemed topically relevant to us for all the reasons that you know what's going on in this country.
Yeah. And now we're probably going to see more people walking around with the swastika downtown. Yeah.
Maybe.
So it's going to be an ongoing question.
Yeah. Yeah, right. Okay, so now you don't have to look backward and decide. You can help us decide about the ongoing question.
Yeah.
What do you just gave a lot of very thoughtful pros and cons. What do you want from KUOW as these things happen?
I'm trying to figure this question out. I think that the media in this country is in a really difficult position right now. And one of the dangers is that a lot of people are getting their news from these conspiracy theory places. And looking at that, I think it's really, really important to maintain some kind of objectivity for you guys. But at the same time, giving them a platform is really dangerous. I do not know how to walk that fine line. I'm thinking about it, but it's a hard call.
Okay, this is history professor Lori Marhofer. Finally, anything that I haven't considered, I've been considering a lot, but what do you think we may have missed, or what do you want to add? Or did we cover it for now?
Let me think about. I was shocked by how well he represented himself yesterday. That was really chilling. That even editing down a much longer interview, I think what he said was really effective. And I think white supremacists probably are really excited that that got on KUOW. Yeah. So they're smart. I think that we are wrong to think that if we just give them a chance to say what they believe, they're going to sound like radical fascists and they're going to turn people off. They're not.
Well, sure sounded that way to the vast majority of the commenters that I saw. But you're saying plenty of other people, significant number of other people would have. Are they being silent?
I think he probably won a lot of people over. And I think that more people in this country agree with far right extremist racist views than we think. Some of the recent polling shows that 1 in 10 Americans think that it's acceptable to hold white supremacist views. Yeah, I think we're underestimating how good they are when they get on the air. Yeah.
Okay. Will you come back and talk again with us?
Of course, anytime.
Thanks for breaking down this with us. As a historian, as a media consumer, as an American, as a human being, really appreciate it.
Sure. Thanks for having me.
University of Washington History Professor Lori Marhofer on KUOW Seattle. In a moment, where could we go to get some peace? Where could we go to get some quiet contemplation and maybe some hope? Stay tuned. Thanks for hanging in there with us on KUOW Seattle. I'm Bill Radke. Now we're going to turn to a symbol that is a symbol of, well, maybe danger, but a symbol of mystery as well, a symbol of peace, a symbol of hope for humanity, the symbol of hope that is nature. On a clear day, Mount Rainier towers over us. On a cloudy day, you can still find its name all over the place, on a high school, on a street, on your beer. But most of the people that live here will never make their way to the top of that mountain or to any of the thousands of other glaciers and rock walls here. So what about the people who do put themselves in those hard-to-reach places, like Dallas Glass, a professional climbing guide with International Mountain Guides, and Daryl Smart, who doesn't climb mountains for a living but still loves it, even after falling into a crevasse while climbing in Ecuador? How did that happen, Daryl?
This was probably about 2 a.m, dark. I was actually climbing without a headlamp. We had enough residual light from the moon. And I punched through with my ice axe, which is not a good sign. And I felt like that's that I might have been on a snow bridge. And so I started probing about. And as I did, I could just feel the entire ground beneath me falling away. And the snow bridge basically was giving way. And as it did, I leaped forward and caught the front wall of the crevasse.
What was going through your mind as that snow beneath you was falling away and you were falling?
It was a really, as I was falling and I felt the security of that rope catch me, that was a really awesome feeling. it was just one of those moments you think, this is just really a good thing that I've got someone so skilled with me to make certain I'm not going to fall. As it turns out, the crevasse was probably maybe 12, 15 meters deep. So I probably wouldn't have been killed, but I could have been hurt seriously. So,
Dallas, someone listening to that on firm ground at sea level might think that is just a dumb risk to take. Why do you do it?
And it may be for some people, but for those of us who love to be in the mountains, it's about getting out there and engaging with nature in a different way. It's about pushing our limits. It's about seeing things that not everybody gets to see. You know, sometimes people ask, like, do you ever get used to the view? And no, never. I've never once gotten up on or near at whatever hour of the night, stumbled out of my tent and said, gosh, that's the same as it was yesterday. It's always new. It's always different. It's always unique. It's always special.
But there is risk in climbing, for certain. There is risk in climbing, but there's risk in driving our cars. And I mean, name something where there's not risk. I think sometimes in modern life, we try and insulate ourselves to such a degree that we've just we've removed the joy of life. I mean, we've got belts, suspenders, and every other safety device to where we can't experience things that we were meant to experience as human beings.
I love hearing a lawyer embracing risk.
I'm a litigator, Dallas.
I totally agree. I think that there's risk in everything out there, and sometimes we treat risk as a dirty word, and it's not. The key for us in the mountains is identifying risk and finding ways to mitigate that risk, to bring it down to a level that we find acceptable. And the reality is everybody has a different acceptance of how much risk they're willing to take. The key that when I'm teaching people, like when Daryl takes an avalanche class, or when I'm teaching crevasse rescue or whatever it happens to be, what we're trying to do is help people make an educated decision. If you're going to go in the mountains and you're going to assume risk, that's fine. But let's do it intentionally, right? Like if you need to run into the burning building to save somebody, that's fine. But realize the building's on fire first. Don't just run into the burning building on accident. So we want to enable people to not just go out there and do risky things. We want to enable people to identify risk. We want to find ways to mitigate that risk. And then we want to bring that down to an acceptable level. And when it's not acceptable, that's when you turn around. That's why we wear a rope on a glacier. So when Daryl falls into a crevasse in Ecuador, he doesn't fall all the way into the crevasse. The rope stops him. That's why we wear crampons, or that's why we carry first aid kits. That's why we do all these things, is because we've identified areas of risk in the mountains. And we're seeking to mitigate those risks.
Daryl, you said that climbing is a natural part of us. You have to learn not to climb.
Oh, absolutely. I think there's just a progression of mankind. I think we start, we crawl, we walk, we run. And you look at any little toddler, if there's something to climb, they're climbing.
Yeah.
It's really in our DNA to climb. And so we almost have to learn not to climb, where people say that's dangerous, you're going to fall. Or someone falls, a young kid will fall and hurt himself, and a toddler, and says, oh, that was not a good thing. So you have to learn how to protect yourself. Learning how to be safe climbing, there are techniques to learn how to do that. But I think just the innate desire to climb something, I think that's part of who we are. I think man was meant to climb. That is the progression of man, and people who climb understand that's really where we need to be.
Crawl, walk, run, climb?
Yes. It's obvious, isn't it?
I like it.
Well, that makes it sound like there's nothing to do but climb.
Yeah, at times I think that's true. You know, I'm 60 now, and you know, I'm still in good enough shape that I can do most things, but again, part of it is just this challenge that I don't want to sit home and watch TV. There are things that I want to do. And I know that the experience that I'm going to have, it may not be life-changing, it may be, but there's going to be things that are going to really, I think, make me a better person mentally and spiritually and physically. All of it is just so important for me.
How are you a better person for climbing?
I had this conversation last night actually with one of my sons-in-law, and we climb a bit together, and really most members of my family climb with me. But it's, you know, people say, well, you're climbing to get to the top of a mountain. Well, yeah, that's the objective, but it's never about the summit. It's about the effort to get to the summit. And there's all these little lessons that occur that are just phenomenal analogies that happen while you're climbing. And we don't control mountains. I think people say, well, you're going to go up and you're going to conquer a mountain. That's ridiculous. We don't conquer anything other than maybe fears that we have or doubts about ourselves. Can I really do this? Do I have the physicality to do this? So those are all things I think that we have to overcome, but we're never conquering the mountain. It's all about us. And mountaineering's hard. That's the reality is, you know, people say, well, you went out and you had fun. Yes, you had fun, but you probably suffered a little bit as well. And you might have suffered a lot. And part of it is that's part of the joy. It's not masochistic. I don't want you to think that. But part of the joy is realizing I'm tamping down some fear here. I'm overcoming something in me that tells me not to do this, and I'm going to do this safe, and I've got people that are going to work with me.
Are you a fearless person at sea level because of your climbing?
No. I don't think so. There's a lot of
came onto the radio. A lot of that would scare some people.
Well, I'm a lawyer. I'm not afraid to talk.
This is pushing my comfort limit.
are you fearless? You brought up conquering fear. Does that translate?
Yeah, and I don't know if conquering fear is.
Oh yeah, you didn't say conquer.
Well, like you're tamping down those emotions, yeah. And you're saying, okay, I've got this. You know, I can do this. And
that applies in the other parts of
life? Oh, it applies it definitely applies to walking into a courtroom. The first lead climb that I did probably 30 years ago, where a lead climb is on traditional gear, is where you're placing protection and then you're climbing on your own protection. That was a terrifying thing for me. That really, and every piece of protection, every bit of pro that I'm placing, I'm double checking it, and I'm thinking, okay, can I really do this? And you're in awkward positions, you know, as you're placing pro, and it's hard to do. And tamping down that fear and again, you know, becoming more comfortable in a vertical environment, I think really is good for us emotionally. I mean, I think it has application in all sorts of other areas of life. Fear keeps people from doing things all the time, whether it's starting a business or getting married or having children or, you know, just even speaking up for people who are disadvantaged or less advantaged. Fear holds us back in so many ways. And I think climbing, there's just so many fantastic analogies. And I think, and again, this is not the primary reason I climb is to overcome fear or to tamp that down. But it is a feature of it, certainly.
I think one of the first times I guided in the St. Elias Range, St. Elias Range is in Alaska. It's in Wrangell-St. Elias National Park. It's the largest national park in our park system. It's about 9 million acres, if I remember right. That's massive. And we were dropped off by our small airplane in the middle of this glacier. Due to weather and landing conditions, we had been landed 180 degrees on the opposite side of the mountain we had intended to climb, 3,000 feet lower than our initial landing location, and about 3 miles farther from the mountain than we had anticipated being landed. When the plane flew away and the utter silence set in, as my small team sat in the middle of this massive amphitheater just pouring with ice, that's when I think I realized how many of these things were falling on my shoulders at that moment. We were in a location we didn't know anything about. We were in a location we didn't know if there was a route. We were in a location where we didn't have a good weather forecast, and no one was going to come check on us for the next 2 weeks. And we went climbing. And it was the most unique and special experience of my life because all those things came into play. We had crevasse falls and we had to lead out on ice that I climbed with one ice axe instead of a set of ice tools like we would like to do normally. We had to carry heavy loads and we had bad weather and bad visibility and we turned around 400 feet from the top. We didn't summit and it was still the most unique and amazing experience because It wasn't just that it was remote. It wasn't just that it was beautiful. It wasn't just that we had to challenge ourselves. It was all these things being wrapped up into one climb where a group of people came together to face a challenge and had a wonderful time. The number of times we sat around and drank cocoa in the tent at night and laughed. The times where you would come out for that alpine twilight that only really happens in the Arctic. And get to see that special color of blue in the sky that happens at like 2 a.m. instead of the sun setting. And it was absolutely one of the most amazing experiences, and I couldn't imagine not having that as part of my life.
Was there a moment in there when you were miserable?
Oh, sure. I was coming down the glacier, coming back to base camp, and I was dragging, I had a pack on that was probably 60 plus pounds, maybe 70 pound pack, and I was dragging a 50 pound duffel. And the snow was just supportable enough to hold you for about a split second when you would set your foot on it, and then it would collapse underneath you. And every time it collapsed, you wondered, am I falling into a crevasse or is it just the snow? And most of the time it was just the snow, and just fighting my way down through this glacier with this massive amount of weight and basically limited visibility. I couldn't see more than a couple hundred feet in any given direction. It was maybe the most challenging thing I've ever done.
Scary?
Sure, absolutely. You're pretty small when you're in the middle of the San Elias Range, and the peaks around you are 16,000 feet tall, and everything is massive blocks of ice and rock, and you are really tiny at that moment.
Do you guys think our new arrivals in the Seattle area, let's say they're here for a job, let's say if they're here to work in the tech industry, do you find that they don't appreciate the natural setting this is, or they appreciate it more because they've actually chosen to be here in this new place?
I think probably both. I mean, I know people that they see this and they're blown away by it immediately. They jump on a mountain bike and, you know, they're going to go out and enjoy this immediately, or they, you know, they start studying and or take a mountaineering course and they end up climbing Rainier or Hood or something. And they just, you know, they embrace this because of, you know, what they see. And I think there's other people that just go, yeah, that's a cool view, and put their head down and don't give it another thought.
You know, several of our friends here in Seattle, when they moved here for work as well, and I met them through my wife's job, and many of them didn't do all this stuff when they moved here, and now they're backcountry skiers, and some of them went rock climbing with us in Leavenworth a few weeks ago, and a couple of them summited a Rainier earlier this summer, and to see them take on this kind of this wild place that we have in our backyard, because it is world-class climbing. And so it's really amazing to see people moving in here. And I think when you described maybe some of the tech workers that come here and they're, you know, wondering how to get into this, you know, neither Daryl or I would be here if somebody hadn't taken us outside. And so one of the things that we really love to push for is mentorship in the outdoors. And that mentorship begins to instill a certain line of ethics, whether that mentorship is professional, you hire a guide to teach you, or whether it's your friend that takes you out climbing for the first time. That whole like kind of line of outdoor ethics with really is summarized very well by Leave No Trace. And if I was to summarize the seven principles of Leave No Trace kind of in one like phrase, it's just being polite to the outside and to other users. That's what it's all about. And so these people that are coming here and they're seeing the outdoors, they're getting to experience it maybe for the first time in their lives. The one thing I would encourage them is really seek out that mentorship. But the Cascades in our backyard, it's amazing. I caught a glimpse of them today as I was going to the grocery store, and I kind of paused, and it's, you know, looking over by I-90, and they all just got snow last night. Like, that's pretty spectacular. The alpine climbing season's coming to an end, but that means the winter climbing season is just around the corner.
You know, we're sitting in a studio, and soon we're going to be outside again, and I feel like I'm going to look around me and feel something a little different. What do you want to leave us with?
I would encourage people to go celebrate the fact we live in this amazing place. Go grab a friend, go out, go for a day hike, go see the larches changing color in the North Cascades, go look at the blueberry bushes right now in full fall foliage down on Mount Rainier. You don't have to climb anything big, just go get outside and have fun. And the more you have fun, the more time you spend out there, the more you're going to appreciate it. And if you want to get into climbing, great. And if you don't, it's no big deal. But celebrate the fact you live in these world-class mountains here in our backyard.
Dallas Glass and Daryl Smart, attorney, climber, guide. It's been great meeting both of you and getting our heads outside together. Thanks a lot.
Thanks so much for having me.
Now, what we didn't get into in that discussion is how mountaineering is a privilege. Who can afford the equipment, the training, the travel, the time? If you have privilege like that and you know that other people don't, do you feel guilty about it? I ask you because in just a moment, we're going to learn why rich people feel bad about being rich, or say they do, if you can get them to talk about money at all. Do you hide your money, and what effect does it have that money, wealth, is something we do not discuss? That's coming up. It's KUOW. I'm Bill Radke. Are you rich? Somebody around here is rich. I've seen the housing prices. We hear about our wealth boom all the time. I have met rich people. At least I assume they're rich, but I don't ask them because it seems rude. It's rude, right? Well, maybe, but what happens when we hide the topic of wealth and we skirt around it, we're coy about it? What effect does that have? My next guest wanted to know, why don't rich people want to talk about money, and what does that silence do? Rachel Sherman's new book is Uneasy Street, The Anxieties of Affluence. Rachel, welcome to KUOW.
Thank you for having me.
As you got to know some rich people, it sounds like you were surprised how awkward they are. Will you give us an example of that?
Sure. I mean, they are uncomfortable talking about money. One of them told me that after the interview that she would have been more comfortable talking about her sex life than talking about her financial choices.
Right. What's an illustration of people being rich and feeling squirmy about it?
Well, somebody I talked to admitted to me that she took the price tags off her clothes when her nanny was around, also took the price tag off her bread just as a way of kind of trying to equalize the relationship between herself, her nanny, her housekeeper.
And wasn't to avoid a conversation where the housekeeper says, how about a raise for me? Was it just, what was behind that, do you think?
Well, it might be partly that. I mean, I don't think that was the way that she would have characterized it, right?
Yeah.
She thought of it as a way of, she also wouldn't have said this, but I think that it's a way of actually just kind of obscuring that inequality to herself. So, of course, the nanny and the housekeeper know that, you know, she and other people that they work for in New York City have a lot more money than they do. But to prevent the person from possibly seeing an actual price tag is to sort of symbolically take that inequality off the table. I think it's really unlikely that someone's household employees are going to challenge them in that way. But that was sort of, you know, her way of kind of hiding it from herself.
Yes, obscuring inequality to ourselves. You also give the example of a couple that purposely does things the hard way, even though they don't have to. They don't quite fix up their place.
Right. The same couple didn't buy an air conditioner. They lived in New York City, which is quite warm in the summer, without an air conditioner for a couple of years, you know, before breaking down and buying it. They lived in a more ratty apartment until they upgraded to a penthouse loft. And the wife in this couple went to the post office to try to get the PH removed from the elevator, you know, the PH that indicates penthouse, removed from the elevator because it made her uncomfortable to see that there.
Yeah. So these are not cases of hiding inequality between you and your nanny. Will you get at what is behind this anxiety about wealth?
Yeah, I mean, I think that people, you know, we think of the U.S. as being this kind of American dream, you know, success is the ideal, everybody wants to be rich. But I think that once people are rich, they feel uncomfortable with it, especially in this moment of, you know, very visible, increasingly kind of politically talked about income inequality that, you know, is extremely high relative to the 20th century, for example. So I think that they are, you know, and people feel this in different ways, but I think the idea of having more than other people when you know that a lot of other people have less than you, especially for people who are, you know, more or less politically liberal, as New Yorkers are and as I think many people in Seattle are,
yes,
becomes very difficult.
Yes. Well, if you're worried about your wealth, wouldn't one solution to that problem be to give your wealth away?
Yeah, but I mean, I don't think that's the solution to the real problem, which is, you know, systemic production of inequality. If I'm wealthy and I give away all my wealth and I don't have any wealth, and maybe some organizations or some individuals or whomever I've given the wealth to have something, but the problem of inequality is not mitigated by that at all.
Yes, but you wouldn't have to feel guilty anymore. I'm saying if your problem is, oh, I've got so much and I know it's not right, I mean, you can solve that even if you're not solving the big societal inequity problem.
Right. But of course, that's not the only thing that these people feel, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, they feel uncomfortable, but they also feel like they want to live in a nice house and they want their kids to have a decent education and they want to be able to travel. And, you know, I think a lot of what the problem is here is the relationship between individual actions and kind of collective distributions, right? So me, that might make me feel better in terms of I wouldn't feel guilty anymore, but then I would feel really worried about surviving, right? Particularly in a country where, you know, the government doesn't support us essentially at all, right? I mean, we're more or less responsible for our own health care, our own retirement. In many places, public education is not what it should be. So, yeah, I think that the extent to which some people think that that would be the answer doesn't make sense in terms of how these people are diagnosing the problem.
Yes, although there's a big gap between being worried about your survival and having all the private education and travel that you want. And in between there, is it fair to accuse those people of hypocrisy who say they feel so uncomfortable about their wealth, but they're not getting rid of it? Or is that too simplistic to call them hypocrites?
I mean, the point of the book is really more that we shouldn't be so invested in judging their individual moves, right? Maybe there's some element of hypocrisy there. I personally, as I've just said, don't really think that them giving away all the money would, you know, do anything better for society. So it doesn't seem to me to be a real solution.
Mm-hmm.
For me, the point is more to think about why are we invested in judging wealthy people for, you know, having too much or spending in particular ways or not working hard enough or not giving enough money back or, you know, acting entitled and, you know, in the ways that we think of rich people doing, or as in the case that you just posited, being hypocrites, right? It's like, I'm not saying that individual wealthy people bear no responsibility, but I think that those kinds of judgments, even when they're negative judgments of individuals, they kind of distract us from thinking about the larger problems of the creation of inequality.
Okay, so on one hand, we have our feeling about America having, and let's not let us off the hook, having very consciously created incredible inequity. At the same time, you're talking about judging individual, really nice-seeming rich people. How do you want us to think about that, about our feelings, our emotions toward richy riches?
Well, I kind of want us to ask what would happen if our feelings toward if we tried to put aside our feelings toward richy riches and we thought instead about the morality of particular kinds of distribution. So a lot of times the individual judgments that we make are moral, right? We say they're not hardworking enough, they're too ostentatious. And for my people, you know, I think that Donald Trump, right, was kind of, before he became president, sort of the epitome of what they don't want to be, the kind of rich person they don't want to be. And these are moral judgments. But what if we tried to make moral judgments of distribution? So what if we said, it doesn't matter if you give away a lot of money, it doesn't matter if you work hard, it doesn't matter if you're a nice person, some people maybe shouldn't have $50 billion or $10 billion or, you know, $10 million. I mean, we can talk about what that would look like, but that even what I'm suggesting is that to make these distinctions between good rich people and bad rich people is to suggest that having super rich people is okay.
Yes, and you're suggesting silence doesn't help. And this is a very appropriate topic in the Seattle area as our wealthy people boom, the inequality increases. We separate our societies, poverty moving more to the suburbs, middle class disappearing. And I'm talking about all of this with Rachel Sherman, whose book is Uneasy Street, The Anxieties of Affluence. And I want to talk to you, the KOW listener. Are you rich? Do you think of yourself as rich? Because those are different things. Here's our phone number, 206-543-5869. Maybe you're one of these 1%ers or 0.1%ers in the Seattle area. What's your experience of it? Because Rachel paints this picture of people squirming and kind of lying to themselves and feeling awkward. And I want to know, what's your story with how you handle money, whatever rich means to you? 206-543-5869. And do you talk about your money? Rachel, you make the claim that our silence is not helping.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think we have a, this is not limited to rich people, right? We
yes.
don't typically ask each other how much money we make. That's, you know, seen as very rude, I think, in most contexts in the U.S., as you said. And yeah, I think, I mean, I'm not advocating that the world is going to change if we suddenly all go around asking each other how much money we make, right? I'm pointing out that not to talk about it, there's a kind of, especially among affluent people, I think there's a sort of, you know, genteel attempt to sort of pretend that it doesn't matter. And we have these cultural norms, not just of not talking about money, but also of, you know, the golden rule, right? Always be nice to everybody. Treat other people the way you want to be treated. Money doesn't matter. You shouldn't be nicer to people because they have money or because they're, you know, people who are different from you should always be treated respectfully and so on. And that creates kind of more silence about social difference.
Well, isn't one reason to be silent about your wealth to prevent somebody from taking it? I mean, maybe someone's going to feel justified in robbing you or swindling you or taking some revenge on you. Is that lurking behind people wanting to play it off like they're not as rich as they are?
Maybe a little bit. I think some super wealthy people, I mean, a couple of people that I interviewed had actually security concerns about people knowing, you know, how much money they had or where they lived and so on. But I think that the norm is so much more widespread than that, right? I mean, people won't talk about their money with their own family members if they come from families where, you know, both if they come from families that have kind of different assets, if they're upwardly mobile, and also people whose families don't live in New York. Among my respondents who were all New Yorkers, you know, didn't want to tell their families what they paid for stuff because their families would think that it was completely insane.
Yeah, I'm part of this, Rachel. I live on, where are you right now? You're in New York?
I'm right in the middle of Manhattan.
In Manhattan, yeah. Okay. Well, I live in a pretty wealthy suburb of Mercer Island, and I always feel like I want to point out to somebody, I don't live on the waterfront, you know? My neighbor calls it the cheap seats. But it's almost like you're a better person if you have less. There's something, it's almost like a status, at least in the Pacific Northwest. I don't know about what it's like in Manhattan, but it's like your status in a sense goes down if somebody else thinks you're a have.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, what you're describing is exactly what the people I talk to would want to do too, is always downplay
yes.
the advantage and sort of upplay the, you know, the not being near the water part of it.
I noticed the rich people wanted to tell you how hard they worked. That was one thing. Like, really? You work harder than a poor single parent, an immigrant, you know, a refugee. But boy, that is really important to them that I work. I'm a hard worker.
Yeah, I mean, that's what's so fascinating to me about it is we always think, like, you know, in the U.S. we have this meritocratic system and we all believe in meritocracy. But of course, lots of people who don't have money also work hard. And the thing is that my respondents know that. You know, I think it's easy to kind of caricature rich people as justifying their wealth on the basis of having worked hard as if that also meant that other people don't work hard. But I think what they're actually doing, because they do know that other people don't work hard. They do know that other people do work hard and don't end up with the same outcomes as they have. But I think what they're doing is kind of making themselves worthy. They're not saying, I have this because I worked hard necessarily. They're often saying, I deserve this because I worked hard. They're not, especially people who have inherited wealth, who know that hard work is not the explanation of their wealth, right? But they still have jobs and think of themselves as hard workers because it's just morally important to do that. But it's also really important to not be an ostentatious consumer, you know, to not be materialistic, not be greedy, to give back, and so on. So it's not only hard work that matters.
Yeah, those are the people that seem to really squirm talking to you, is the people whose wealth was all inherited.
Yeah, they screw. I mean, especially politically progressive inheritors of wealth, you know, they who are not earning wealth, because lots of people who are working in finance or otherwise earning their money also have inherited wealth. And certainly most of them have started out, you know, upper middle class. And now they may be wealthier because finance can make you so wealthy now. But yeah, I think that those people who the combination of inheriting money and having progressive politics leads to the more kind of classic liberal guilt. But I do think that people in families with earned income, you know, and just the word earned has this kind of moral dimension, right, that like they're entitled to it because they've earned it. I think that those people are still uncomfortable having more than other people, and they still want to be these kind of, you know, good, rich people, these morally worthy rich people.
We have a phone call from Walter in Queen Anne. Walter, how much wealth do you want to anonymously admit to?
Oh, me? I've been through $1 million or so. I probably live in a house valued at $1 million on Queen Anne. It's pretty hard not to be, even though it's one of the smaller houses. But I grew up on Fifth Avenue in New York City, and I went to the same school that the president sent his children to. And it's a pretty horrible elite crowd. I mean, these people, so you understand, create places for themselves. You know, they're country clubs, yacht clubs. You know, so I'm saying that they segregate themselves. You're not going to get them to open up much about their wealth unless you're wealthy. And they tend to fall into two categories of bringing up the children. You bring them up as if they are poor and that they will have to make a living their whole life and earn a degree and live that way. And then there's the other type that also get a good education, but they're brought up to understand that they're going to have millions of dollars in the bank, plenty of money, and they do not have to work, but they often work as a pleasing facade. You know, some of the neo-Freudians believe that work replaces sex as we get older.
There's sex again. But yeah, what do you think of that, Rachel, how we bring up our children?
Yeah, well, that's something that a lot of the people that I spoke to were very concerned with, right? I mean, even across the board, like the progressive inheritors versus the, you know, finance people are really worried about entitled children. And entitlement is a very dirty word for all of these people. And I think, you know, kind of in general in U.S. culture. I mean, what the caller says is sort of, I don't think it's necessarily divided into two sets of people among the people I spoke to, but it's two different ways of raising children. They really want their kids to understand, you know, to have a work ethic, to give money away. They do not be materialistic, but at the same time, they want their kids to have all the possible advantages that they can. And so they often struggle between setting limits on the kids in some ways and then trying to, you know, help them develop themselves in every possible dimension.
Rachel, I mentioned Mercer Island waterfront versus the interior. Here's another Seattle distinction. Walter, when you say Queen Anne, are we talking top of Queen Anne?
You know what's really weird is I'm aware of the distinction, and I even know where the top of Queen Anne is, exactly on what streets north and south it ends. And yeah, I'm at the top of it, and as you go down, it's a little less wealthy. It's a really odd psychology in our white city, but please understand that most of the wealthy white people, whether they work for it or they inherit it, these wealthy white are not aware of their privilege, their automatic privilege, that when I walk to a jewelry store and I press a button to get in the door, they automatically zap me in because they can identify that I'm wearing a wrinkled cotton shirt in the middle of a business day, meaning I have a certain power of independence. I don't have to dress for anybody.
So,
but I might not be aware of that when I walk in.
So, Walter, finally, you mentioned you said they were a horrible elite crowd and they segregate themselves. You're on top of Queen Anne with $1 million house. Is it your self-awareness that makes you not horrible?
Thank you very much. No, I participate in this horribleness and I recognize that I am somewhat horrible. Let me also say, I bought my house when it was workers up here back over 30 years ago when we were workers up here. The guy next to me tested torpedoes. The other guy next to me was a plumber. And now those people can't afford it. I am lucky because I bought my house so long ago. But let me also say, I'm included in that. I haven't been marching enough. I haven't been saying to my white friends, hey, we need some more color up on the hill. I have to do my job better, and the white wealthy people of Seattle must stand up and say, hey, we need to be taxed. We need to be taking responsibility for our position of wealth. I mean, please understand that no matter how sensitive we think Mr. Gates is giving his billions of dollars away, that giving that money away also creates a sensitivity, a public relations society, makes him a softer guy, but he had to charge too much money to be able to acquire that wealth. So I am guilty as the others are, and I need more whiteys who are wealthy to stand up and be more generous.
Walter, thank you so much for that call. I really appreciate that. You're telling your story. You're telling about the top of the hill, and you bought it 30 years ago, and now what are you going to do about it? Because really, I didn't suggest this segment and call Rachel Sherman so we could all feel guilty. I wanted to know what we're going to do about it, and Walter brought us right there, Rachel, is that what's the point of doing anything if you're just whining and sort of in a self-congratulatory way, I found in a lot of the people you talk to.
Yeah, I mean, but they're not necessarily only whining, and as I said, many of them don't want to talk about it at all. So they're revealing something to me
that's true.
I don't think Walter is going around talking about this either, you know. Mm. And I would just point out what he does is both admit his own privilege. And as you kind of highlighted, you know, he says, I live in the small house and I've had the house for a long time. Right. These are the same kinds of moves that my respondents were making.
Is there something wrong with that in pointing out, well, when I bought, it was this kind of neighborhood. I didn't buy it at $1 million.
No, I don't think there's anything wrong with it. And this is, again, it's like judging whether it's wrong or right or good or bad is part of the problem. I'm just highlighting that it's the same thing that you did. It's the same thing that many people with privilege want to do is distance themselves from the privilege by saying, I'm not as privileged as someone else. And in Walter's case, to say those real rich people are horrible and are isolating themselves in exclusive clubs and so on.
And by the way, I purposely think of myself as rich. People who know me don't think of me that way, but I think I'm rich because I don't think I'm ever going to go hungry or cold. Whether I'm right or wrong, I make decisions based on that impression. I value time over money. So I don't know. I guess, are we talking to just about rich people here? I wonder whether middle-class Americans feel guilty about being richer than the average Cambodian.
Yeah, well, I mean, that depends a lot on what you mean by middle class. You know, I don't know what your income is, but my guess would be that you would be in the top 10% of earners in Seattle, right? And to think about, maybe you don't want to identify as rich, or maybe someone in your position mostly wouldn't want to, but to identify as privileged vis-a-vis the rest, I think is really important. And then thus to not only be thinking about the Bill Gateses or the 0.1% as the actual rich people, but to be able to talk about privilege, you know, with regard to people below you as well is really important.
Rachel Sherman, her new book is Uneasy Street, The Anxieties of Affluence. You may have seen her recent New York Times piece. That's where I first saw it. Yes, that's the same Rachel Sherman. And it's a great discussion anywhere, especially in 2017 in the Puget Sound area, as I think you know, Rachel. Thank you so much for this.
Thank you.
And thank you for tuning in to KUOW. I look forward to talking with you again tomorrow.